This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who was born in Nigeria, has won a raft of awards, including the Genius Grant, as it's known, the MacArthur Fellowship, and a National Book Critics Circle Award for her best-selling novel, Americana. But who cares about that? Because how many fiction writers have been sampled by Beyoncé?
We teach girls to shrink themselves, to make themselves smaller. We say to girls, you can have ambition, but not too much. You should aim to be successful, but not too successful. Otherwise, you will threaten the man. Because I am female, I am expected to aspire to marriage.
But Adichie is not a woman easily cowed by fame. She later questioned the attention that came her way, the assumption that she should somehow be grateful. And she criticized Beyoncé, saying in so many words that the singer spent maybe a little bit too much time talking about men. In her novels, Adichie has written about life in Nigeria and that country's long civil war, and about a Nigerian immigrant in the United States who became a popular blogger. I sat down with Adichie at the New Yorker Festival in October, and she told me about her experience of coming to live in America as a young woman.
I came to the U.S. because I was fleeing the study of medicine.
You were running away.
Yes. I had started in Nigeria in medical school. Because, you know, you do well in school, they tell you you have to be a doctor. And I kind of went along with that. And I had it all nicely planned out. I was going to become a psychiatrist, and then I was going to use my patient stories for my fiction. That was kind of the plan, right? And then a year into my studying medicine, I just thought, I'm so unhappy. I couldn't do it. And so I decided to try and go to America. I got a scholarship, so it wasn't actually that my sort of parents sent me off. And part of the reason that America became the dream place to go to was because England felt too familiar, and the system is too much like the Nigerian system, which is they start very early on to put you in a track. So I was in the science track. You know, the bright kids were in the science track. Mm-hmm. And if you were considered to be intelligent, you were not supposed to be interested in art and history. You were supposed to like chemistry and physics. And so for me, America became this place where a friend of mine who had come here said to me that she took classes in music and biology. And I thought this was the most exciting thing.
And what was you, when you landed in Philadelphia, I know you had been, as a kid, you were in California because your father taught there. So America wasn't a complete shock to the system.
Yeah.
But here you are now a young woman, you're 18?
Yep.
What are your first impressions of suddenly being in Philadelphia?
Do you know it's difficult to say? I mean, I guess I was very excited, obviously. I was also kind of disappointed because there's a sense in which obviously reality never quite fits with one's imagination. So I imagined that everything in America was clean and shiny and bright, you know, and it wasn't. And that disappointed me profoundly. Mm-hmm. So I lived in West Philly, which, you know, I had an apartment. I lived with three American young women in an apartment. And the first time I went to see the apartment, I was just shocked.
How so?
Because, you know, again, in my head, I thought, you know, I'm going to share an apartment with Americans, and it's Philadelphia. And so they open the door, the stairs are creaky, the carpeting is old, the bits at the corners where it looks like rats have gnawed at it. And I just thought, really? And so it was just really, I remember the stove looking so old. And I remember thinking, you know, our stove in Osuka is very shiny compared to this. Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of, there's a kind of disappointment. But I do have to say that when I started classes, it was just this incredible exhilaration.
You say that there are some writers that are write as the result of other writers,
yeah,
or responding to literature,
yeah,
and some writers that write out of life. As a writer, what do you want your stories to do? What do you want your stories to do to these people in this room and who are clicking on you and Amazon and picking up that book? What do you not think about that much? Is it an activity that's basically for you, and then it goes out into the world and does something magical, mysterious, commercial, whatever it might be?
All of this. What do I want it to do for these people? I want it to give them much happiness and fantastic, perfect skin and hair. And, so this is, please buy my book, that's what will happen.
So it's like oil of Olay.
Yes. The dream life awaits you. I think that's a good question because I don't think about it. I mean, but on the other hand, it is complex because I think to claim that you don't think about it, then why write? I mean, we write, or rather we publish, because I do think writing and publishing are two very separate things. And you know, we publish because we seek a certain connection. We want to be read. I think I write the kind of fiction I like to read, and I know that I look for fiction that delights me, that instructs me, that feels rooted in some kind of humanity.
You have a phrase that I don't know necessarily is for polite company about your definition of a fuck you book. You describe Americana as your, I'll say it again, because why not, fuck you book. What do you mean by that?
I said that.
Yeah, you did. See, it's right here.
Oh, goodness. I don't know. I can't hold my alcohol. And I think I was what I was trying to say, and I do stand by that, actually, not backing away. It's that sense of writing from a place of freedom. And I wanted to write about, obviously, Americana in many ways is about leaving home, about immigration, but it's also much of it that's set in Nigeria and England, but it's quite American. So I wanted to write about my take on America, and much of it was about race. And I had realized, having lived here long enough, that when it comes to literary fiction, you're not supposed to write directly about race. I mean, if you do write about race, it's supposed to be subtle, and there's a lot that's supposed to go under that word nuance. And much of the writing about race I just found to be dishonest. I would read some fiction and be like, no, right? And it seemed to me also quite ideological. You know, that idea, you know, the sort of thing like race is just a social construction, but all of that. And I just felt that...
Yeah, you don't put up with liberal cant and jargon, whether it's on subjects of feminism or race, at all, despite politics.
I don't. I mean, obviously, I'm. Well, that's my sort of tribe in many ways, because America doesn't give you many choices. They're too stuck.
Ideologically.
Yes. Yeah. It's my ideological tribe. So
you're saying that your ideological tribe kind of pisses you off a little bit.
Yeah.
How so?
I think the left in this country is creating its own decline. I think the left doesn't know how to be a tribe in the way the right does. The left is cannibalistic. It eats its own. This isn't going to sound very kind, and I, but...
We're not here for kindness.
People on the left, you know, so there's something to be said, of course, for ideals, and I believe very much in that. But I think when one speaks about politics, sometimes there can be a kind of, an extremist idea of purity. And it's so easy to fall afoul of the ridiculously high standards set there. And there's often also a kind of self-righteousness. I mean, sometimes, I remember when I was at Yale in graduate school, and I would sometimes be in gatherings of, you know, this fiercely leftist, crusading, well-meaning people, you know, all of whom recycled. I used to feel very tainted because I thought, my God, they're all...
Recycling.
Yeah, I mean, I thought they're all so good. I mean, they have no flaws. And I used to sit there thinking, really? I mean, you know, they would never buy any clothes that were made in sweatshops. They just seem to... And I used to think, sometimes I don't know where my clothes are made, but if it's cheap, I'll buy it, you know? And there's an orthodoxy. There's a kind of, you follow the rules, and if you don't, you're cut down very quickly.
And you've had this happen to you.
I have.
What's the most painful one?
I think it was my comments about transgender women. It wasn't even, I mean, in some ways, I think...
You should maybe explain what...
So I had done an interview in London, and this woman had said to me, I don't remember the question, but what I did say was that I think trans women are trans women, and that I think there's a difference between trans women and women who are born female. And apparently, in liberal orthodoxy, you're not supposed to say that. Because in the quest for inclusiveness, the left is willing to discard a certain kind of complex truth. And I think there's a quickness to assign ill intent. So I remember thinking...
How did you feel it coming? How did the blowback come at you?
Tons of emails from friends saying, hope you're doing well. and don't worry, we have your back. And, you know, just take this time off and get a massage. And I, you know, and because...
In other words, they were on Twitter and you weren't.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I knew it was bad because I was getting all these messages. It was as though somebody had died, seriously.
Yeah.
And, you know, initially I didn't take it seriously because I thought, surely, nobody thinks that. I mean, I sort of feel that that the space I occupy in the world is one that is... Of course for inclusiveness, right? That of course I couldn't possibly be suggesting that trans women are not part of feminism, which apparently had been how it had been seen.
Right.
But I think it was simply that I didn't use the language I was supposed to use. Seriously, friends sent me flowers. And
it's nice to know they care.
Well, they did, but then I thought, my God, what is going on? And then, you know, my publishers were inundated with, you know, interview requests. There were people who were like, does she want to take her words back now? And I just thought, what? Oh, and then I did public events where there's a woman who stood up and lectured me for 30 minutes about how I was killing trans women and how I had no compassion and how I needed to shut up. And it's interesting because a lot of sort of liberal, the response is not to debate, the response is to silence. And I find that very troubling.
When you look at the speech issue here,
yes,
which has gotten complicated from Yale to Berkeley,
yep,
and not just on college campuses, but centered on college campuses. How do you react to that?
I guess I'm just a person who thinks that the answer to bad speech is more speech in general.
So the classic liberal view of speech.
I do. I feel that way because I think that, and also I suppose maybe not being American hells because I sort of look at the people, I mean, there's the man with the unpronounceable name who... Milo something?
Oh, Milo Yiannopoulos.
Yeah, because there was all the noise at Berkeley was because of him, right? And then there was the noise at Middlebury because of the guy who wrote The Bell Curve. I then went and read The Bell Curve.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just thought, it's actually not even very interesting. It's not very good. And I think it's very easy to discount. And you know, I spoke to a young woman who... She said to me, she was white, but she said, you know, I have black friends in my college and we want to protect them. And I said, it's very strange because America is a country that is steeped in racism. So how are you protecting this young woman in a college by not having a speaker come when she steps out into the world, into the American world, she's stepping out into racism?
Now, one of your biggest discoveries is when you came here was that there was a thing, it was blackness.
Yes.
Which you did not experience.
No.
In Nigeria.
No, there was no reason for me to think of myself as black in Nigeria.
So this came to you as a shock or a comedy or some
as both.
Yeah.
All of those things. I mean, racism I found funny, absurd, infuriating.
How did you experience it?
The first time I wrote an essay in a class, my very first essay, and and at the time I used my initial and my last name, and my last name I think could be anything. Some people sometimes tell me it could be Italian. So the professor came into the class and said, "Who wrote this essay?" All right, and he called my name, and I raised my hand, and he looked surprised. And even though it was a very small moment, that's when I knew what being black meant. It meant that you're not supposed to write the best essay in class if you're black. Mm-hmm. It meant that black achievement is considered so rare, so, you know.
The violence of low expectations.
I was irritated by that because for me, growing up in Nigeria, you know, black achievement is ordinary. But then it became other things. It became, I remember once a black guy referred to me as sister. And my first reaction was, no, I'm not your sister. And you know, I talk about that now because
you thought it was rude.
No. It was me backing away from blackness because I knew that in America, blackness is a bad thing. So in some ways, my denying my sisterhood with him was, in some, it's an indictment of American racism. You know, if being black in America didn't come with a lot of crap, I wouldn't have said, no, I'm not your sister. And now I want to find him and hug him and say, I am so your sister, right? Mm-hmm. But it took, and so in some ways, blackness is, so America thrusts it on you in the way that...
Why be here? In other words, I'm here, I was born here. I don't know where else to go.
Oh, I have suggestions for you.
Please, I could use an invitation. The act of immigration, when it's not an act of desperation, and I don't think that was an act of desperation in your biography, is an assertive action.
Yeah.
It's a leaving home, and it's a choosing.
Yeah.
A limited range of choices, maybe, but it is an act of choosing. What does being in America do for you as a human being and your daughter's future?
I have always admired the sense in this country of possibility. And only here do I feel it. It doesn't matter if it's true. I feel it. And that's
enough. It's a story.
Yes.
You've said that you would sell more books in Nigeria if you didn't call yourself a feminist. Nevertheless, you very much do call yourself a feminist. Why would that be? Tell us about the situation there where this is concerned.
Feminist is a bad word in Nigeria. A feminist is a person who is unhappy, as some people have told me. It's a person who hates men. But feminist is a bad word all over the world, actually. Feminist is a bad word in this country. I mean, look at how Hillary Clinton was treated when she was running for president. But in Nigeria, there's a kind of directness. So people will say, oh, you know, we cannot have a woman be governor of so-and-so state, or a woman can't run because people will not vote for a woman. And because it's so direct, there's a sense in which it's almost refreshing, you know what you're dealing with. And so to choose to identify myself as feminist publicly, I think, was to almost like sort of putting a target on my forehead because, you know, obviously I knew it was a bad word. But I did hope to start a conversation. I hope to inspire both women and men.
What is the shape of Nigerian feminism? I mean, what does it look like? How limited or not is it?
Nigeria actually has a tradition, a feminist tradition. And increasingly, I find that I want to think and talk about that more and more because I think Western feminism, having been the most documented feminism, mm-hmm. can often seem like the only feminism, right? As though there haven't been movements of sort of insubordinate women in Asia and Latin America and Africa, right? I think today, I mean, my mother's generation, my mother was born in 1942, I think held more closely to a sense of autonomy a sense of autonomy, not to say that they were equal in the eyes of the law or because they were not, in sort of cultural norms, they were not. I sometimes think that my generation, there's a kind of conservative strain that didn't exist 50 years ago, where marriage is what everybody aspires to. And I talk to young women in Lagos and they're all talking about, I'm 24, I haven't met the one.
I'll be an old maid.
Yeah, and I just feel like, no, you need to go do something with your
life. Was your household different?
Yes, sort of. I mean, as things go, my parents were progressive for the time and place. I was never sort of told that I had to get married, but the expectation was there.
Right.
That's what, you know, you get your degree, you get your master's, you get your PhD, you get the husband.
After the PhD?
For my family, yes. For other families, I think no.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. You can read some of her stories at newyorker.com, and you can find her now famous talk, We Should All Be Feminists, on YouTube or wherever. Still ahead, a performance from singer-songwriter Laura Marling. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Perhaps she's had too much of love. Can be a sickly thing.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we're bringing you interviews from the New Yorker Festival that took place a couple of months ago. Now, often at the festival, my colleague John Seabrook will interview one of the more interesting songwriters or pop musicians of the day, and we get to hear a little music. Laura Marling released her first album when she was 18 years old, but it didn't feel like the work of someone who'd just earned the right to vote. Marling is 27 now, with six albums already behind her, and her particular brand of dense but delicate folk music has earned her all kinds of awards, the acclaim of critics, and a lot of passionate fans, like John Seabrook.
In my work, I meet quite a few artists that are very good singers. Some of those artists are also good players, and a few of those artists are also good songwriters, but I never meet someone who is as good as you are at each of those categories, any one of which would probably make you a very successful artist. So you're a real artist. Welcome. You're fantastic.
Thank you. Thanks.
And Laura and I actually know each other. We met a couple years ago. We played Boggle together. But anyway, so Laura, that was in April of 2015 when you were coming off of your last album, Short Movie. Talk about what you were doing in California those years. You had four great albums, and then you left Britain and went to California. Why?
I was touring by myself. So after my fourth record, which was Once I Was an Eagle,
right?
I had been touring with a band for 8 years, I guess, or 7 years, and I was tired of that.
Yeah.
So I decided to go and tour the States just on my own.
I read something you said interesting. You said that because you started so young, and when you start touring and when you go out, your sort of emotional development is sort of arrested by the nature of touring.
Yeah.
It's hard to develop as a person. And what can you talk a little about? What is it about touring that kind of arrests you in terms of development?
Well, you basically employ someone to be your parent, you know, full-time carer. Right.
That's your tour manager?
Yeah. It's a really thankless job. But, yeah, you know, you are given a schedule every day. You're told where to shower and at what time.
Right.
And it's very limiting. And it's, you know, it's very claustrophobic. It can be if your mindset begins to make it that way.
Right.
It becomes sort of terrifyingly claustrophobic.
And that was part of what drove you to California, that wanting to get out of that cycle?
Yeah. Well, I did the tour of the States and it was, you know, magical and I had a lot of adventures. And then I just landed in LA, not somewhere I had ever even sort of romanticized in my head.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I landed there and I stayed there. And I found that really from the claustrophobic mindset that I was in, LA was kind of perfect.
I mean, the other thing about California with you, and we were talking a little about this earlier, Laura had a father who loved 60s singer-songwriters, in particular, Neil Young. And one of your very first songs that he taught you was The Needle and the Damage Done, which I think you later recorded with Jack White.
Yeah.
It's a really great version, by the way. But I think on the Joni Mitchell, he actually had you sit and listen as a very young person to Joni Mitchell, right?
Yeah.
And I was asking you earlier, do you think he kind of wanted to make you into Joni Mitchell?
It's creepy to think that maybe he did.
Because maybe it worked.
Yeah.
But anyway, can you talk a little bit about having a father who was a record producer who influenced you musically?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was saying earlier, I think Joni Mitchell was the only female songwriter he could think to put in front of me.
Have you felt like Joni Mitchell has become a musical touchstone for you? I mean, your voice in that middle range, up and down, sounds somewhat like Joni Mitchell.
Wow, that's very kind.
I mean... And you're a brilliant songwriter like Joni Mitchell, and you're blonde.
And I'm a lady.
And you're a lady.
I think... Yeah.
But and then you went to California. I guess that's what I was thinking of. Like, wasn't that part of your California trip? Just to maybe reckon with some of these archetypes that you kind of grew up with?
Yeah, someone was asking me the other day whether I lived in Laurel Canyon when I was there, and I was like, no, you can't afford to live in Laurel Canyon. Are you kidding me?
Right.
But so as soon as I got there, all of that mysticism was gone. Mm. Do you know what I mean? But there are still there is this mystical thing in LA that the old school guys and girls are there. You know, you feel that they're there in the hills looking down on the city. And you hear about, you know, because most of my friends are musicians and they, you know, talk about playing with Jackson Browne at the weekend or, you know.
They're like the old fathers up there.
Yeah.
Down. David Crosby up there.
David Crosby, of course.
Like a Buddha.
Yeah.
If you grow up listening to a lot of Joni Mitchell, then you end up having a lot of guitar tunings, which is what's happening there.
That's John Seabrook talking with Laura Marling at the New Yorker Festival in 2017. And here's Laura Marling playing The Valley. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for listening.
She stayed in town last night. Didn't get in touch. I know she has my number right. She can't face seeing us. She sings in the valley. Many a morning I have worn, longing to ask her what she's mourning, because I know it can't be spoken. Of love can be a sickly thing. That's why she mourns the morning dew and the newness that it brings. She sings in the valley. Many a morning I have worn, longing to ask her what she's mourning. Of course I know it can't be spoken. I love her in the morning. I love her in the day.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with special help from Rhonda Sherman, Eric Malinsky, Alexis Goldberg, David Ohana, Hillary Lechter-Griffin, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.